This is the last of our Stranger Things series, and I really hope you have enjoyed this series. Now, this week, our story reads more like it comes out of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings more than it does the Bible. We find it in Genesis chapter 6 in the opening verses of that chapter. Now, this passage sets up the story of Noah and the ark and the reasons why God saw the need to destroy the whole world with a flood. Now, the second part of the passage is the part of the story I guess we're more familiar with, that humanity had become so wickedness, and this wickedness had spread so far and so wide that God regretted that he had made people. And the only way to save humanity was to destroy humanity except for one family, the family of Noah. But the opening four verses of Genesis 6 give us another explanation for the flood, and it's some rather strange stuff. It talks about the sons of God marrying and having children with the daughters of men or the daughters of people. And it connects this to a strange race called the Nephilim. And we're told that the Nephilim were the mighty heroes of old. So a rather mysterious reference here. Now, when we begin to pull on this thread, we find that it's a thread that runs throughout the Bible, and it leads us potentially to some rather surprising conclusions. So let's just read this text from Genesis chapter 6, beginning with verse 1. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal, and their days will be 120 years. So God's first response to whatever happening here is to greatly reduce the human lifespan. Remember, before this, you know, people were living hundreds of years, and now we're getting down to a much more modern lifespan of 120 years. But that doesn't seem to be enough. Verse 4 continues. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, "I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Now, there's some strange things going on in this passage. God wants to destroy humanity because they have become irredeemably wicked. And a part of this wickedness stems from these sons of God coming and marrying and having children with the daughters of people. And these children don't seem to be ordinary children, right? They're called Nephilim, and we're told that they are the heroes of old, the men of renown. And God's response to this is to first limit the lifespan of humanity and then eventually to wipe out humanity. Now, here's where things get really weird. Who are these Nephilim? Well, the word Nephilim, and it's interesting to me that the translators simply carry this Hebrew word over into English letters. They transliterate it. They don't translate it. But this word in Hebrew means giants. Right? This passage is talking about giants. Now, if you have read the Old Testament at all, this is not a complete shocker, right? Because some of the enemies that Israel had to deal with in the Promised Land were giants. remember the 12 spies that were sent in to the land of Canaan to scope out the promised land? All right, well, when they come back, only two of them, Caleb and Joshua, have a positive report saying, hey, we can do this. This is a good land, and with God's help, we can take it. Well, here's what the other 10 spies reported in Numbers chapter 13, verses 31 through 33. But the men who had come up with him said, we can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, the land we explored devoured those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. All right, there's that word again. The Nephilim, the giants there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. These spies didn't think they could take the land because there were Nephilim living there. There were giants there. Right? Compared to them, we looked like grasshoppers, and they could squash us just as easily. We also get this little parenthetical remark that the Nephilim are also known by this other name, the sons of Anak, or the descendants of Anak. In the Hebrew, it's the Anakim. In some English translations, they're called the Anakites. But sons of Anak, Anakim, Anakites, all the same thing. Now, when you learn about this story of the 12 spies in Sunday school or in church, it's usually about faith winning out over fear, right? These 10 spies didn't have enough faith in God that God could help Israel win over this enemy because they put more stock in their fear of the giants than they did their faith. Now, Caleb and Joshua, however, they believed that God could give them victory. And so the moral of the story is usually be like Caleb and Joshua rather than these other 10 spies. Now, that's all true and good as far as it goes, but there's more going on here. Now, the incident with the 12 spies happens about 2 years into Israel's journey through the Sinai Peninsula. They escape from Egypt, they cross the Red Sea, and God takes them to Sinai, where they spend the better part of 2 years receiving the law and building the tabernacle and all of the items that go in it. And God basically setting them apart and putting his identity on them as his people. Then after that's done, they go from there to the border of the Promised Land, immediately send out these spies. And had they had faith, they could have immediately gone in and taken the promised land at that point. But because of their unbelief, right, because of their lack of faith at this point, they then have to spend 38 more years wandering around the Sinai wilderness, basically as God is waiting for an entire generation of the Jews to die off. Now, so 4 decades later, they come back again to the promised land. And have you ever wondered what happened to the giants when Israel shows back up? Well, the giants are still there, right? They still populate the land. A key reason why God gives Israel this particular land, the land of Canaan, was because God wanted to rid the earth of the people who lived there, right? The local population was to be entirely wiped out. Entire cities were, and the euphemism the Bible uses is devoted to destruction. Right? Nobody left alive, no looting, no spoils of war, everything wiped out. And here's what we read in Joshua 10:40. It says, so Joshua struck the whole land, the hill country, and the Negev, and the lowland, and the slopes, and all their kings. He left nothing remaining, but devoted to destruction all that breathed, just as the Lord God of Israel commanded. this is one of those Old Testament passages that causes modern readers to squirm, right? And it makes many modern believers uncomfortable trying to defend this. And this is where those accusations that the Old Testament God was a cruel and heartless tyrant, it's where they come from. I mean, how could any good and loving God tell his people to wipe out entire populations, including women and children? The reason that God sends in Israel to wipe them out, at least in part, I mean, part of it is that they are thoroughly, totally wicked. This is a people and a culture so devoted to pagan idol worship, things that were abhorrent to God, that there was no redeeming them. And God didn't send Israel in until every possibility of a second chance was completely gone. There's a passage in the Old Testament that says that the sin of the Canaanites had not yet reached its full measure. Right? So God was giving them every chance, every opportunity, until the situation there was beyond fixing, beyond redemption. But the other reason that God sends Israel in there is because of the Nephilim, right? There were Anakim or Anakites living there in that land. They were the descendants of the Nephilim described in Genesis 6. And God wanted to get rid of them, right? This was a deliberate attempt at genocide, the wiping out of an entire genetic line of people. God was removing the Nephilim or the Anakim from the land. Let me read Joshua chapter 11, 21 and 22. Give you an idea. It says, "And Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim, or the giants, from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah and from the hill country of Israel. Joshua devoted them to destruction with their cities. There was none of the Anakim or the Anakites or the giants left in the land of the people of Israel. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod did some remain." So some of these giant descendants of the Nephilim, all of these, they're wiped out. Joshua destroys them, all of them. Well, almost. It mentions that there are three cities where some remain: Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. Now, I don't know if any of those names ring a bell, but they are three of the chief cities of the Philistines. Now, the Philistines were Israel's perennial enemy, a constant thorn in their side. They were one of the peoples that Israel was supposed to wipe out when they entered the promised land, but they never did. And so they continued to be a problem for generations. Well, which leads us to another story. Israel had to keep dealing with these descendants of the Nephilim, these giants, until the time of David. And of course, we all remember the story of David and Goliath. Now, Goliath was, well, you guessed it, he was a Philistine. He was from one of those three cities, the city of Gath, and he was an Anakim, a descendant of the Nephilim. And he was one of those who wasn't wiped out by Joshua. What we don't remember, though, is that Goliath wasn't the only one. The end of 2 Samuel 21 tells a story of how David's warriors hunted down and killed four other giants with supersized heavy weapons. Right? One of them had six fingers and six toes. And each one of them, like Goliath, is said to be a descendant of Rapha. That's probably their dad's name, which means they, all five of them, were brothers. Right? This is the last time that giants are ever a problem for Israel again in Scripture. Right, their genetic line seems to be finally and fully wiped out. So, Why? Why are the Nephilim or the Anakim, these giant descendants of the sons of God and the daughters of men, why was God so intent on wiping them out? Why is God so intent on destroying each and every last remaining Nephilim? So much so that he sends a flood to destroy the earth. So much so that he sends the nation of Israel into Canaan with a license to kill and a mission to kill each and every single one of them. So much so that David's warriors hunt the last of them down like a group of medieval knights looking for the last dragon. Well, go back to Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. The sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. Let's ask the question, who are these sons of God having children with the daughters of humans? Now, the interpretation that I was taught in Bible college was that these sons of God were the righteous descendants of Seth. Seth was the third son of Adam and Eve, born after Cain and Abel. And you might remember the story of Cain and Abel. Cain, was not righteous. Abel was. Cain kills his brother Abel. And so Seth and his descendants, those are the sons of God, but his descendants intermarry with the descendants of the wicked Cain, and thus kind of corrupting the human family tree, if you will. But that explanation never sat right with me. And the more I read it, the more I studied it, it was like I was adding 2 + 2 and coming up with 16. Something didn't make sense here. So you begin to pull on this thread and some surprising things come up. Let's take a look at some other passages of scripture. First, we're going to go to the book of Job. Beginning in Job chapter 1, verse 6, here's what we read. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Now, many translations don't say sons of God there, although that's what it says in the Hebrew. It'll say angels there. And the reason why it supplies angels is because the translators know that, well, sons of God means angels. These aren't people presenting themselves in the heavenly throne room before God. It's spiritual creatures, these spiritual beings, Satan being among them. In a similar way, in chapter 2, verse 1, we read this, and there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. There are several passages of scripture that create this picture of a divine council. Think of a king who has a council of advisors who help him administrate his kingdom. Well, there are these angels who help God administrate his reign over both the spiritual realm, the supernatural realm, and the physical realm. And so this divine council comes and they present themselves before God, and they issue their reports, their findings. And so the angels are called the sons of God here. Now, not in the same way that Jesus is the Son of God. All right, Jesus is the Son of God because he's of the same essence as God. But these are sons of God in that they are spiritual beings like God is, and they are created by God. Next, we go to Job chapter 38. And this is where God finally shows up after all of these chapters of questions and accusations. And God speaks to Job. And his basic point to Job is this: Job, who are you to question me? I'm God and you're not. And in verse 4, he starts off asking him where he was in creation. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? And then he lists out all these aspects of creation. Can you explain this? Where were you when I did that? And you get down to verse 7, and he's like, where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Right? So this is creation. And the sons of God are rejoicing in God's creative handiwork. Well, who are these sons of God? It can't be people because they're not created yet. Well, they're angels. These are angels shouting for joy. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 8 and 9. Here's what we read. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, so talking about different languages and ethnic groups, people groups here, he fixed the borders or the territories of the people according to the number of the sons of God. Right? So he assigned these different people groups according to the number of the angels. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage. So what God is doing here is he's creating all these different people groups, and he is delegating authority over them to various spiritual beings, various angels, what are called sons of God here. All right, and he's telling them, right, you're over these people. You are to run things. You are to administrate and manage this. But God is saying, but my people is Israel. Right? Israel is my territory. I'm going to take care of things there. You guys can run everything else, but this one's mine. Now, you bring all this back to Genesis 6. I believe the most obvious interpretation here is that the sons of God who were coming to the daughters of men were angels. And a part of their angelic rebellion, which led to God casting one third of the angels from heaven, was that these angels came to earth, manifested themselves in human form, and had relations with women who were willing to step far outside of the bounds that God had set for them. And this union between these sons of God, these angelic creatures, and these human women leads to this genetic line of Nephilim or Anakim, which even hundreds of years later still gives us Goliath, who's nearly 10 feet tall. Right? This is why their offspring are giants capable of feats of superhuman strength, right? Because they are the spawn of this illicit union between rebellious angels and human women. Now, the Jewish understanding, the ancient Jewish understanding of this passage is that the sons of God were rebellious angels. In fact, ancient Jewish texts even give these angels names and say there were about 200 of them. Now, I'm not sure how much stock we put in any of that, but it does let us know how they understood this passage. This was also the understanding of the early church until the time of Augustine, who had trouble with this idea of angels and people procreating. And of course, Augustine had a huge influence in the church. And so for hundreds of years, the interpretation, most Christian interpretations, moved in this direction that, well, the sons of God must be the righteous descendants of Seth. The problem with that interpretation is it doesn't explain the Nephilim, right? Why would normal human fathers marrying normal human women have giant babies, right? That doesn't make sense. And it also ignores how the Bible uses this phrase, sons of God, in other places. Now, there are some passages where God refers to Israel as his sons or his son. But that particular phrase, sons of God, that's angels, right? That's angelic beings. And so, in recent decades, biblical scholarship has been moving back to the original understanding of this passage. Now, I should be clear, in fairness, there are still very godly biblical scholars that hold to the idea that the sons of God are not angels, but the descendants of Seth. And I respect their scholarship, but I don't think it is compelling. The most straightforward reading of this text is that the Nephilim are the spawn of unholy unions between fallen angels and human wicked women. Now, that leads to this question of why? What's the point other than the angels are being selfish and think that these women are beautiful? There's certainly just a selfish, lustful aspect to this story. But I think it's deeper than this. I think Satan has a greater purpose. If you go back to God's promise in Genesis 3, I think you see a reason for this. You remember in Genesis 3, it's the story of the fall of man, the sin of Adam and Eve. They eat of the forbidden fruit, you know, and part of the consequences of that is this curse. You know, part of it for Eve was there will be labor pains and childbirth. For Adam, there's going to be, you're going to have to work by the sweat of your brow, and you're going to have to work through thorns and through thistles. But God also makes this promise. He says that the seed or the offspring of the woman will one day crush the head of the serpent, Satan. Satan's thinking, I believe, is that if he is able to completely corrupt the human gene pool, that maybe that promise will never take place. He is trying to destroy the messianic bloodline so the Messiah can never come. So that's why the flood happens. Right? That's why these four verses about the Nephilim are included in an explanation for the flood. By flooding the earth and saving only one family, right? One family with a purely human genetic line, God is able to preserve that bloodline and rid the earth of this corrupted gene pool. But then this brings up another question. If the flood wiped out the Nephilim, then how is it that we still have Nephilim on the earth after the flood? Well, there's a couple of explanations given for this. One of them is, well, the flood didn't destroy everything, and obviously there were some Nephilim that survived somewhere. But as a Bible-believing Christian, I don't accept that. The Bible portrays a worldwide flood, and I believe that's what it was. So I don't think that explanation really satisfies. But another explanation does, and that is this, that rebellious angels continued to mate with human women after the flood. And you can even read Genesis 6:4 in this way. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God came in to the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. That phrase, and also afterward, applies not only to the Nephilim, but it applies to the sons of God coming into the daughters of men. Genesis 6, 1 through 4, is Satan's attempt to destroy the promised messianic bloodline. This also explains why God acted so swiftly and so severely to remove this evil from the face of the planet. It also explains why God sends Israel into the promised land on a specific mission to wipe out all of the descendants of the Nephilim. Because they had the potential to destroy the human race and corrupt the messianic bloodline. They were the game-breaking bug in the code, and it had to be deleted. Now, if we continue to pull on this thread, it explains a couple of other mysterious passages all the way in the New Testament. Both Jude and Peter have some strange references to God chaining angels in the abyss. 2 Peter 2:4 says this, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to the chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment." Now, hell here is not the lake of fire, hell, right? In the Greek, the word used here is Tartarus, right? This is the bad part of the abyss, what the Greeks called Hades or what the Jews called Sheol, right? This is the bad part of this. This is the waiting room where the wicked dead await judgment. So there are these angels who have been preemptively sent to the abyss where they await their final judgment. Right? Well, why? Why were these angels sent there and chained there until judgment? Similarly, in Jude 6, it says this, and the angels who did not stay with their own within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. And so you've got these angels who've rebelled against God, and they have stepped outside of the authority delegated to them by God. And as a result, God has confined them ahead of time until final judgment. Now, I don't think this is all rebellious angels. This isn't all demons, because there were certainly demons at work after this. There were demons at work in the time of Christ. There were demons at work in the early church. And I believe demons are still at work today. And we know from the book of Revelation that Satan and the rest of his fallen angels will be defeated and thrown into the lake of fire at the end. But these rebellious angels, these ones who abandon their proper dwelling to have illicit unions with human women, they were chained in the abyss until final judgment. God was telling them, you won't be doing that anymore. This also explains why demons don't dare try this again, right? They don't want to be immediately sent to the abyss, which is something that God has the power to do. You might remember the demons in Luke chapter 8. They were cast out of a man who was living among the tombs on the far side of the Sea of Galilee. And Luke 8:31, it says, they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. They knew Jesus could do it. They knew who he was, but they didn't want to be sent there, you know, ahead of time. And they begged Jesus to let them go into a herd of pigs, which they immediately caused to go down a steep embankment and drown in the sea. It also explains one other reference we find in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 through 22, beginning with verse 18. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but being made alive in the spirit. Then here's verse 19. Listen to this. In which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, which is another way of referring to the abyss. So who are these spirits? What is Jesus proclaiming to them? What prison is this? Verse 20, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. So whatever these spirits did, whatever prison they were sent to, whatever Jesus proclaimed is somehow connected to what happened in the days of Noah. All right, interesting, huh? Well, I believe these spirits in prison would be the fallen angels chained in the abyss after their sinful union with human women. So what's Jesus proclaiming? Well, picture this as a victory dance, a touchdown celebration. So after Jesus is crucified and he dies, he descends into the abyss, the place, the abode of the dead. And he shows them their plan did not work. The Messiah still came just as promised, and even his death on a cross did not defeat him. All of their efforts were in vain, and then Jesus rises again. And so in just two verses, down in verse 22, we get this triumphant proclamation of Jesus' victory, that Jesus has gone into heaven, is at the right hand of God with angels, authorities and powers having been subjected to him. Right, this is the same language that Paul uses to describe the hierarchy of spiritual beings, you know, principalities and powers. There are these different levels of angels and demons. And Jesus is victorious over all of them. They have all been subjected to him. And so after Jesus proclaims his victory over these spirits in prison, his triumph is then complete. He's raised to life, and then he ascends back into heaven where he assumes his place at the right hand of the Father. Amazing stuff. But you may have noticed there that I skipped over one verse there in 1 Peter 3. It's verse 21, which of all things talks about baptism. And so this is where I want to tie everything together in this message. Peter compares the ark that saved Noah's family through the flood to Christian baptism. And here's what he says. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you. Not as removal of dirt from the body. It's not a magic bath, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I bet you never thought of your baptism in these terms, right? Who would connect baptism with angels and demons and giants and spiritual warfare and a conspiracy to corrupt the messianic bloodline? But Peter sees baptism as something that joins you to the triumphant victory of Jesus, the victory that he won over the spiritual forces of darkness that conspired against him to keep him from ever coming. Baptism is more than just a symbol. It's more than just a ritual. It's more than just an act of obedience. It is an act of victory. And though it is something that we act out in the physical, natural world, baptism is ultimately a spiritual act that I believe achieves very real ends in the spiritual realm. It accomplishes something very real, very deep, and very powerful. I think there's a great mystery here. There's aspects of this we'll never understand as long as we are in the flesh. But baptism connects us, connects you to the great triumphant victory by which Jesus defeated all of these spiritual forces of darkness, right? And it's this salvation that secures your spot at the right hand of the Father, at the right hand of Jesus, over these spiritual forces of darkness, over all of these authorities and powers. And this is why Satan has zero power over you unless you give it to him, because he's defeated. As a Christian, you do not have to walk in defeat. As a Christian, you can walk in victory, because the victory has already been won, and your baptism spiritually connects you to that victory. Awesome.